It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin is home to more than 130 memory cafes, including a new monthly bilingual cafe in Racine. A worldwide memory cafe tracker, it raises awareness about these social events designed for people living with memory loss and their caregivers. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Diane Rogstad is Outreach Supervisor for the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Racine County. Diane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we have Wendy Bettley here as well, Senior Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association Wisconsin Chapter. Wendy, welcome.
Thank you, and good morning to everyone.
Wendy, let's start with you. You know, what qualifies as a memory cafe? Can you give us a little bit of a primer there?
Sure. So memory cafes started in Wisconsin back in 2011, 2012, and the purpose of them was to allow individuals who are impacted by memory loss in the earlier stages, as well as their care partners, an outlet to get together, to connect with others, and to have an opportunity to be together, not worry about the disease. So we call it kind of a disease-free environment. But it's really just to provide extra socialization for individuals and their care partner at this journey.
Do you find that there are social stigmas attached with dementia? What type of, you know, difference does a memory cafe make for that situation?
Yeah, so a lot of people are still unaware of what Alzheimer's disease is and other types of dementia. There's a lot of thought processes out there that these individuals can't do anything or they can't be part of society anymore. People picture them as being much older, and all of that is false. And the cafes really show an opportunity that people can still be involved in the community and continue to live life well. And I can give a great example, is we had started a cafe at another location many years ago when we first started this, and just bringing people into an environment. It was at a local restaurant. The waitresses and staff there were surprised in how well people were who were living with memory loss, and they learned a lot themselves. So just that little bit breaks down that stigma of Alzheimer's disease.
Diane, you overseeing outreach efforts for the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Racine County. Your organization hosts a bilingual memory cafe. How is that going?
Well, we started that in June of 2023, and it's going fairly well. Every month is a little bit different, different activities and different people in attendance, but we're off to a good start.
And can you talk a little bit about what happens at your memory cafes and what the gathering is like?
Well, we really work with the people that are there. So, and really work on, you know, strengths that they have. So bring them in. It's a comfortable social gathering, play games. They love to play bingo. Music is always a favorite. Do different activities based on what they're interested in. For example, February being that it's Valentine's Day, they asked if we could make some Valentine's cards and give that to their loved ones. So we will be doing some of those things this month. So,
are there any little rituals or moments that happen at memory cafes that happen each time?
I think the biggest part that happens each time is the social connection between the individuals that do come, and they really start building those relationships, and they are really understanding that they're not alone and that they can, you know, be in the community and do social connections and stuff, even while addressing some sort of memory loss.
We're talking about memory cafes in Wisconsin, offering support to people living with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. Diane Rogstad oversees outreach with Racine County's Aging and Disability Resource Center. Wendy Bettley is here, lead senior programming with the Wisconsin chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, does a memory cafe venue or a setting matter? What about the place that people gather?
Yeah, so, you know, you can really have a memory cafe anywhere, but I always like to look at memory cafes as a place that you would go and hang out with friends or maybe go on a date with your loved one or, you know, do that type of event location. So there are places that we hold them at libraries. There's lots of libraries throughout the state of Wisconsin that offer these. There are restaurants that offer these, coffee shops. Some senior centers will offer it. And so it's just a good opportunity to reconnect into the community. So I always like it when they're offered and at libraries and in coffee shops, just because it brings people back into a place that they're more familiar with and they can reconnect and utilize those resources.
Wendy, what do you think of bilingual memory cafes?
I was very excited when Racine started theirs. It's utmost importance, especially with the population of Latinos in our community, you know, are at a higher risk of developing memory loss than Caucasian. So it's important that we offer memory cafes to all communities throughout Wisconsin.
Diane, what led Racine County to launch a bilingual memory cafe last year?
The Racine demographics show that our Hispanic population is at about 14%. And it was really important to us to really offer supports and the memory cafe to the entire community. So it was important that we expanded into a bilingual cafe so that everyone felt welcome within those settings. So,
Do you think are memory cafes an aspect of creating a dementia-friendly community?
Definitely. I think that that it's important to really understand that a dementia-friendly community is something that we work very hard for. We have trained the Racine Public Library. We have several other memory cafes in Racine County as well. And those locations are also trained to be dementia-friendly. And we continue to work with the community to try and train as many people and make the awareness of Alzheimer's and dementia to be welcoming to those individuals and their caregivers.
Diane Rogstad is Outreach Supervisor for the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Racine County. Wendy Bettley is Senior Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association Wisconsin Chapter. As we discuss memory cafes, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts anytime, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about memory cafes, social gatherings, allowing people who experience memory loss, along with their loved ones, the ability to enjoy activities together, like making Valentines and making connections at the same time. A new bilingual memory cafe offering is underway in Racine. And Diane Rogstad is with the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Racine County. Wendy Bettley is with the Alzheimer's Association Wisconsin Chapter. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, the State Health Department estimates roughly 120,000 people are living with Alzheimer's disease. How does your association measure the success of local programming and meeting the needs of Wisconsinites living with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so we listen to the constituents in Wisconsin. They are telling us, you know, what's needed, what they want. We provide care and support services throughout the state, and being able to have that dialogue and understanding what their needs are utmost importance. And it may not be what we as the association may provide directly, but it may be what other organizations such as the Aging Disability Resource Centers throughout Wisconsin that can also provide assistance with their dementia care specialists that they have. So, you know, it's really just taking the time, listening to where people are at, and doing our best to find a way to help navigate what they're going through and provide those resources to them.
Do you find are the needs changing and growing in the communities and people you talk with?
Yeah, I really think, you know, one thing that's really sparked from COVID is the realization of isolation has been a big challenge. And so trying to increase the ability for people to get out and do social engagement activities like memory cafes is really important. We've also seen that, you know, there's a lot of communities in Wisconsin, rural, underrepresented communities that really need additional resources. I also saw a shift in people who are actually identifying that they're experiencing some memory loss at a much earlier age than, you know, and sooner in the disease process than mm-hmm. before. So, yeah, things are changing. You know, that we've got a lot of new technology. People are becoming more aware of the disease. Not enough. We still need to do a lot more awareness. But I do see a little change happening.
Diane, what support does the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Racine County offer for families managing Alzheimer's disease?
The ADRC has a dementia care specialist that really is passionate about that position and goes out and does training and education to individuals, families, groups, businesses, from all aspects, whether it be, you know, a business to work with individuals that are coming in and dealing with a memory loss, to individuals who have just been diagnosed and now what, and where do you go, and how does this journey start and begin? We also have a caregiver support team. We have four lovely ladies that follow caregivers through the journey to help strengthen their awareness of taking care of others, those with dementia or Alzheimer's, as well as taking care of themselves at the same time to really, you know, maximize the independence that they can have and for the quality of life purposes.
As you talk about caregivers and the support they need, I think it's interesting to bring up the distinction that memory cafes, that they're not meant to be respite programs for caregivers. Can you, Diane, elaborate on that?
The person with memory loss and their loved one, whether it be a family, a friend, maybe even a caregiver that comes into the home to come with them, really brings that connection with others in the community to be able to really support them, you know, to know that you're not alone, to have that socialization and make those connections is important for us. And I really think that it strengthens the ability for us to work with them and to address the journey that they're on and to be able to help meet their needs as the needs change with the disease process.
Do you find with the caregiver support team in Racine County that they see caregivers perhaps under a lot of emotional stress and other stresses in their ability to offer that care and support for a loved one?
Caregiving is one of the hardest jobs you can have. So we say there's more than 24 hours in a day when you're a caregiver because it's 24/7. And so the need for some respite and the need for the support is there. There's no doubt that caregiving is one of the hardest jobs you can have.
Wendy, how does the Alzheimer's Association Wisconsin chapter look at the caregiving aspect and what caregivers need in order to be able to help that loved one through this disease?
Yeah, so everyone's journey is a little different. And we provide additional support in providing support groups, education programs for family members as well. And you really have to listen. I mean, like I had said earlier, every journey is different along the way, and you just have to be there and be with them and present in that moment.
Hmm. What is your advice for families when a caregiver is unable to take care of their loved one with Alzheimer's? Wendy, you first.
Yeah, reach out. It's amazing the support that's available in the state of Wisconsin. Reach out to your local Aging Disability Resource Centers, your Alzheimer's Association. There's a lot of organizations that can provide that. Don't be afraid to ask for help. I think asking for help is one of the hardest things to do, but it's also the best thing to do, because they're not in this alone. A lot of times people, you know, they receive this diagnosis, the care partner is overwhelmed, they feel themselves getting tired, but it's nice to be able to connect with others, which helps make the journey maybe a little bit easier.
Wendy Bettley with us with the Alzheimer's Association Wisconsin chapter, Diane Rogstad with Racine County's Aging and Disability Resource Center, as we look at supporting people living with Alzheimer's disease and their caregivers. Call in questions and comments. Welcome. 800-642-1234. Paul in Summit is here. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for a great show. Both my parents died of Alzheimer's, and I oversaw their care for about the last 8 years of their life, and I watched them waste away. I'm the youngest of seven. I recently did a medical memory history of all of my siblings. My three oldest siblings have Alzheimer's or dementia. Mm-hmm. It is a fatal disease. And recently I talked to my brother, and we were talking about end-of-life options. It's something that's not really talked about. You know, I personally, there's a good possibility I'll have it. I do not want to waste away for 2 years, you know, in a nursing home. I saw what that was like on a day-to-day basis. And it's something that's not really discussed, to give people end-of-life options for people that know that they have it, that they're moving further along, and they don't want that to be their end story. And you know, talking about that respectfully, it's a difficult conversation to have, but one that I find that I am now having with a sibling and talking to other people about it. Thanks for the great show.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much for calling in on such a difficult situation topic. Diane, what comes up for you?
I think that it's important to plan ahead. I kudos to him that he is talking with his siblings and having those discussions. Really know what your advanced directives are and to reach out and connect with others to figure out what you need to do to plan ahead is very important in this process.
Wendy, what are your thoughts for Paul and Summit?
I agree with exactly what Diane had mentioned. Planning early, having those discussions, and be willing to listen to what that person wants and be open to have that conversation. Those are conversations that are not easy for anyone to have. And knowing that, you know, he's already dealt with, you know, two family members and now more, that's really got to be a hard thing to go through for him. But again, I agree. Kudos to him for coming forward, having those discussions. I tell people all the time, don't avoid those conversations. Start them early. Start planning early. 'Cause once you understand what people want, then you can help them better.
Diane, I want to circle back to memory cafes here as we close. I'm wondering just what relationships develop and flourish at these memory cafe events. What do you hear?
There's some lifelong relationships that happen. We have caregivers that have become friends, spouses, or whatever, that maybe have had memory loss, and those connections where they get together outside of Memory Cafe. They go for dinner. Those folks that they can pick up the phone and talk to when the day and celebrate, or maybe something's going on and they just needed someone to talk to. They're very important to be social and to have someone there that is be able to listen to them. And that's great.
Well, Diane and Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Diane Rogstad is Outreach Supervisor for the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Racine County. Wendy Bentley is Senior Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association Wisconsin Chapter. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Leaders of the Wisconsin College Democrats and Republicans join us to share their vision for rallying their base on campuses in a battleground state. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a food tradition.
Cooking can help us stay connected to our roots, our family's culture. That's the case for Mara Rintamaki of Oshkosh, who grew up in Brazil. Maria Brunetta brings us the story of the restaurant owner and one of her favorite dishes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
It's lunchtime. The scent of Bobó de Camarão, the special of the day, fills the air. The relaxing sounds of bossa nova play in the background. I'm transported to my beautiful home country of Brazil when I look around the vibrant and colorful restaurant. Brazilian restaurants in Wisconsin are rare. In Milwaukee and Madison, there are traditional steakhouses, which offer an elaborate all-you-can-eat experience. But Mara's Brazilian cuisine in downtown Oshkosh encapsulates the feeling of going to my grandma's house for a Sunday lunch.
It's funny because here in the U.S., I feel like everybody that ever hear about Brazilian food, they stereotype with barbecue, right? The churrasco, it's what it's known for.
That's Mara Rintamaki, owner of Mara's Brazilian Cuisine.
I'm the completely opposite of the standard Brazilian stereotype here in the U.S. I actually do the home cooking meals, the meals that you eat in your mama and your grandma's house in Brazil, and that's the food that I want to show people a little bit more about the culture, you know, and the ethnicity of Brazil.
Rintamaki has been living in the U.S. for over 15 years. She quickly discovered her friends loved her cooking. Her specialty is cheese bread, or pão de queijo, a delectable baked ball made of tapioca flour and cheese. She started selling it at the farmer's market.
Eventually, the little dream became a little bigger dream, and I opened the restaurant, and it was beyond the cheese bread.
Now, Mara's Brazilian Cuisine offers Brazilian home-cooked meals like feijoada, the national dish of Brazil. There's also stroganoff, made the Brazilian way.
I know beef stroganoff is from so many other countries, right? But we cook a little bit different. We make the beef stroganoff with white rice, and then we serve with potato sticks, and it's a big comfort food.
The stroganoff is made with small mushrooms or hearts of palm, one of my favorite additions to the dish. For me, what really ties the dish together is the potato sticks. It's a necessity that adds a crunchy bite to the meat and the rice. For Rintamaki, the ingredients give the dish the taste of home cooking.
In reality, it's just the same food that they cook every day, but it's with the Brazilian flair. I use like hearts of palm, I use palm oil, I use a little bit of different ingredients that make that home cooking just, you know, Brazilian.
Beef stroganoff is one dish that immediately brings me back home. It's typically made with either chicken or beef in a table cream and ketchup sauce. The ingredients create a creamy and tangy flavor unlike anything else I've ever had. The Brazilian community in Wisconsin is still relatively small, but it's growing. I grew up in southern Wisconsin after moving from Brazil in 2008. There, we found a community that became our family, much like what Rintamaki has found in northern Wisconsin. And she keeps an open door at Mara's Brazilian Cuisine for anyone who wants to become a part of her community.
Come to Mama. I come here and have some big plate of feijoada, which is the black beans. I will make you feel like you're home, and I will not make you feel alone. I come here anytime.
That story was produced by Maria Brunetta, a Wisconsin Life production assistant and UW-Madison student. And the feature is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the 2024 presidential campaign enters a new phase, we meet the leaders of college Democrats and Republicans here in Wisconsin and explore their efforts to mobilize young voters. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jake Williams, we start out with, chairperson of the College Democrats of Wisconsin, a senior majoring in public administration at UW-La Crosse. Jake, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So with President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump vying to be their party's nominees, how are college Democrats preparing for a potential Biden-Trump rematch?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely, you know, getting ready for the 2024 election cycle. We are, you know, doing our best to educate our peers about how to vote, when to vote, and the key issues that will be on the ballot, like abortion.
So how to vote, when to vote, how do you go about doing that? How do you inform students how to do this and how to vote, especially in their home communities?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a two-pronged approach. We kind of pride ourselves on being, you know, a big tent party and kind of use peer-to-peer kind of relaying of information. So we try and bring as many people into the organization as possible so that they can get the best information and then tell their friends. But then also we do a lot of work in activism, whether that be tabling, passing out information, or on social media or TikTok, relaying the information, trying to be in the spaces that our peers are in.
In recent years, statewide elections in Wisconsin, they've been won by narrow margins. As you know, we are a battleground state. How pivotal will the college vote be in 2024?
I mean, I think it's going to be one of the most important votes. I mean, Wisconsin is a purple state, and elections have always been won in the margins. And I think the college vote, or at least like the youth vote in Wisconsin, has certainly like proved itself in the last couple of election cycles, whether that be, you know, for Tony Evers or Janet Protasiewicz. But also I think it'll be even more crucial for all the down ballot races, you know, state Senate, state assembly, you know, your local elected officials. So across the ballot, up and down, I think the youth vote's going to be very important.
What issues rise to the top? What are the biggest concerns of college-age voters as you hear it?
I mean, I think the big three are, one, reproductive rights. There's kind of an assault on those rights across the board, across the nation. The second one, I would say, is environmental, you know, making sure that we're good stewards of the land and are able to, you know, pass on the natural beauty of America to the next generation. And then finally, I think it's economic rights, making sure that everyone has a fair shot in the economy and is able to, you know, remain in Wisconsin after graduating.
Looking inward in higher ed, in December, the Board of Regents for state universities approved a deal with Republican lawmakers in exchange for authorizing the pay raises for university staff and funding for construction projects. The Regents agreed to roll back efforts to grow campus diversity. Wondering, what are your thoughts on that deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good that, teachers are at least seeing a pay raise, but I think on the whole, the deal was really bad for our university communities. DEI initiatives or diversity and inclusion are intended to try and bring people into the state who have historically been left out of higher education. And I think really what it shows, or at least what, Robin Voss and the legislative Republicans are kind of saying to the rest of the nation is, don't come to Wisconsin. We're not going to, be a welcoming state.
The agreement requiring UW-Madison to create a faculty position that's focused on conservative thought. How do campus Democrats feel about increasing student exposure to more diverse political viewpoints?
I think good. I mean, like, when you're on social media, just existing in the world, you come across a lot of viewpoints that you both agree and disagree with. I know college Democrats who are actually interested in taking that class just to kind of better understand that viewpoint. So I think it's good in terms of the marketplace of ideas.
What is free speech like on campus, and how do you talk about it with fellow students?
I mean, I think there's, a real clear distinction that we make, kind of as college Democrats between free speech and hate speech. Certainly, you can hold any position, but definitely I think we should call out hate speech, even if it is protected, and to try and create, kind of like a safe space on campus. But generally, what we're saying is kind of all ideas should be debated and discussed.
When looking at discussions, as chair of the College Democrats of Wisconsin, you have a seat on the administrative committee of the state Democratic Party. And wondering how well do the priorities of the state party match up with the concerns of the college age voters?
I mean, I think the priorities are better aligning in the last couple election cycles. And I think that, given the rising importance of youth issues, that both the state party and Democratic candidates are beginning to message more effectively to young people, kind of around those, prior 3 points of reproductive rights, environment, and economic rights.
Where is more work to be done?
I think definitely more work at the state level needs to be put into investing into young people. We have a lot of really, really good youth talent in the wings, and making sure that there's opportunity for them to get involved. On our side as college Democrats, I think it's just a question of keeping at it, keep messaging, keep reaching out to our peers, keep pushing, the message of, how to vote, where to vote, and what are going to be the key issues and the values up in the election.
When you talk about youth and there's vitality, there are young people in the wings, it reminds me of the sentiment that we hear out there that President Biden is too old to be president. When you hear statements like that, what is your response?
I mean, when I hear that, it's like, yeah, Donald Trump is equally old. Like, when you're looking at the election, a majority of Americans did not want to see a rematch between Biden and Trump. And generally, I guess, in my opinion, our politics do skew a little too old. But, when it comes down to like election time and when you have to vote, I tell my peers, look, on the ballot, you're going to have Biden and you're going to have Trump. And right now, Joe Biden is the only candidate speaking to the values that young people hold and the issues that matter to us most. So it's kind of a question of, would you rather see progress for 4 more years or regression for another 4 years?
Jake, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
Jake Williams is chairperson of the College Democrats of Wisconsin and a student at UW-La Crosse. This conversation continues with the leader of the College Republicans student organization in Wisconsin. Call in with a question, add comments along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss political strategies on college campuses ahead of the 2024 presidential election and what it means to be a college Republican in Wisconsin. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. Billy Blathras is chairman of the UW-Madison College Republicans, chairman of the Wisconsin Federation of College Republicans, and vice president of outreach for College Republicans of America, a junior at UW-Madison, double majoring in political science and history. Billy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So last month, you and a few dozen other college Republicans from Wisconsin campaigned in Iowa for former President Donald Trump in the run-up to his caucus victory there. What did your effort involve?
Yeah, so we organized a couple dozen from Wisconsin, then 8 or 9 different states and Washington, D.C. So it was a national effort with the Wisconsin College Republicans and then College Republicans of America as well. And we went to the HQ in Des Moines, fighting through one of the worst snowstorms we've seen in a couple of years for the former president. And there we helped them out with phone banking operations. We got to go to an event with President Trump where we got to meet him, shake his hand, talk to him for a little bit, which was an amazing experience for our whole team. Then we'd help them out with some signs and just some more get out the vote efforts to push him over that 50% threshold in Iowa that weekend.
Can you tell us about your experience meeting the former president?
Yeah, I've had the chance to meet former President Trump twice. I met him at a rally in Cedar Rapids where I was able to get a one-on-one photograph with him. Then again in Des Moines, both times were just incredible experiences, kind of surreal in a way. Get to talk to him for a little bit and watch him interact with our students. And it was just very cool. Everyone had a really amazing time there and just kind of an unforgettable experience for all of our college Republicans and something I was really proud of to lead our state group into.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, what tactics or strategies did you learn in Iowa or did you observe in Iowa that you could bring back to your work in campaigning here on college campuses?
Yeah, I guess the biggest thing is looking at like the passion of those involved and kind of replicating that. Their drive for victory really was something I observed and something we really need to replicate both at our college level and then I guess at the professional level in electioneering in this state. So kind of working with their team there and taking some of those practices, at least, or the mentality too, and bringing that back here to Wisconsin.
So on April 2nd, the date of our primary election here, students at state universities will be on spring break. Why are you encouraging Republicans to vote for former President Trump rather than former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley?
Yeah, overwhelmingly, we've seen since our last state convention back in April of 2023, just an overwhelming support for President Trump among our college Republicans. I think to them, you speak to them more on the issues, especially when it comes to kind of foreign policy and just his dynamic change, the changes brought to the political realm. A lot of us would say we're pretty against like the neoconservative agenda pushed by Nikki Haley. We don't want more wars. We don't want to be interventionists across the global scale. We kind of want to put the American people first is what all my students are telling me and something I agree with as well. So we just kind of see that President Trump's the best vehicle for that in the primary field.
So when you focus on domestic issues, what are the things that are rising up that you hear from college students that you want the next president to focus on?
Yeah, if I recall correctly, when we were in Iowa, we did an interview with Real America's Voice. And there, every single one of our students who they interviewed, I think it was eight of us, everyone said immigration. So immigration really is one we're seeing as a huge issue among our college Republicans, like on the national, like a national level issue. And something a lot of our chapters keep advocating for a lot more stricter border policy and calling our reps, advocating with them that, hey, this is what we want out of like Wisconsin. And this is what we want Wisconsin representing at the national level.
Turning to higher education, in December, the Board of Regents for State Universities agreeing with Republican lawmakers to roll back diversity and inclusion efforts in exchange for authorizing staff pay raises and for construction projects. Do you support this deal?
Yeah, absolutely. I think kind of one of our biggest issues with our colleges and universities in general is kind of the bloated administration. So any deal that's going to roll back departments that are overbearing, incredibly costly, is something that I think is a huge benefit to students. It's going to help lower tuition costs in some regards and just kind of slim down administrations. And I think that was a pretty decent deal from the legislature there. So good job on them.
And the agreement directing UW-Madison to create a faculty position focused on conservative thought. How necessary is this role?
I would say there's definitely a role for it. It'll make sure we don't have incidents where kind of conservative thoughts trampled on or mass protested, making sure it's all heard instead of being advocated for by a professional instead of just students. We'll probably have a good benefit across the board. And then if this position is implemented, I hope that our college Republicans can work closely with them to make sure kind of our needs and our things we're advocating for are met by the university.
What are the needs of college Republicans on campus?
Yeah, first and foremost, really the biggest issue is making sure kind of our right to free speech isn't hindered. We haven't had too many issues specifically with that at the individual student level. I know there's like been protests with speakers in the past, but at the student level, we just kind of want to make sure like we're not getting completely silenced in classes. We're making sure everyone kind of has the right to have their opinion, at least to state their opinion instead of being shouted down or hindered by any professors. So that's kind of the biggest thing is individual student freedom of speech. So that's kind of the issue we'd want to work closest with them on.
In our last moments together, you were recently promoted to a national leadership position in the College Republicans of America. How well are Republicans at the national level taking into account the issues that are important to college students?
Yeah, with the College Republicans of America, which is a new organization that I played a part in founding with the College Republicans of California, we really look at what issues are most important to students. We're always asking for feedback from our chapters. And as the largest college Republicans organization in the country, that's something that's really contributed to our success. We're hearing what our students' most important issues are and we're reflecting that in our national policy positions and who we're endorsing for different offices, et cetera. So really looking at that student vision and what's important to our chapters was kind of key to our success and something that we're going to keep doing going forward.
Billy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Billy Blathras, chairman of the UW-Madison College Republicans. And earlier, we spoke with Jake Williams, chairperson of the College Democrats of Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Hollywood's award season is upon us, we check in on the Oscar buzz and hear your predictions and explore films you think deserve to take home that golden statuette at the 96th Academy Awards. Be part of this Oscars discussion. Call in with a question. Share perspective, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater. Anna, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, happy to be back and talk about some great movies from 2023, for sure.
Yes, so let's take stock here. There were actor strikes, there were work stoppages, there was the midsummer box office Barbenheimer phenomenon. How would you depict the year in film? What words would you use?
Yeah, so I, you know, despite all of the sort of setbacks with the strike and unrest, it was really actually a really strong year, one of the stronger years I think in recent memory. And I think, you know, studio executives, I think, may be at last realizing that everyone's kind of tired of superhero movies and that, you know, there is actual audience demand for, you know, good creative movies. And when those stories, right, have the backing of, you know, really strong directors and good writers and excellent acting, people are going to show up. The audience is going to show up. And I think that's ultimately the lesson of Barbenheimer, is that, you know, people want to see good movies.
Oh, you mean they have like an appetite for quantum physics?
Right, exactly. And yeah, and you think about, you know, there are elements to Oppenheimer that are, you know, are very, you know, confusing, right? It is a kind of a talky movie in lots of respects, but, you know, ultimately it has some excellent acting. It has some beautiful cinematography, and it tells really, you know, one of the, you know, most incredible stories of the 20th century. And so, you know, people responded to that. And now, of course, you know, the various, you know, award seasons are responding to it as well, right? So I think that's the lesson. And ultimately, that, you know, Hollywood, I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, back in full force, but it's certainly, I think that Hollywood has really rebounded from kind of the nadir of a few year of 2021, when, you know, theaters were just really trying to figure out how to move forward from the pandemic. So, yeah.
You know, going deeper there on Oppenheimer and maybe some lessons learned, you know, as we look at, you know, threats and geopolitical threats, I'm just wondering, has it furthered a conversation about the role of nuclear weapons and what we should learn, you know, from generations ago in the Manhattan Project?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, I think the other element right now that I think is certainly added to Oppenheimer's sort of success is the instability in our geopolitics right now, right? And so that I think perhaps is a factor, people wanting to learn their history, their nation's history, and then kind of all of the complexities of that. And I think, you know, that is one thing that Christopher Nolan, the director of Oppenheimer, you know, he, you know, again, one of the reasons the film is so talky is because he actually is using real congressional testimony in part of the script. And so that history, right, is so crucial. But, you know, Nolan doesn't really skimp corners either, right? He's giving us kind of elements, you know, elements there of reality, right, with how this story unfolded.
In
And
3 hours.
right, and it is dense, it is long, but there's enough there too, of course, with the, you know, the Trinity, you know, dramatizing the Trinity test, which is just such an incredible sequence in the film, that also provides the action, right, that people are seeking too, right, to kind of, because if it was just congressional testimony for 3 hours,
No,
that would be pretty
no,
dry, right? So yeah, but you know, it's not just Oppenheimer, right? You know, Martin Scorsese has proven that, you know, again, people are going to go to 3.5 hours of you know, with Killers of the Flower Moon, and so, you know, this is a good year ultimately for historians in a way, because we have two films that are based on nonfiction, you know, dense nonfiction books, right, that are sort of, you know, retelling a sto these stories that have kind of gotten lost to history, and finding ways, audience are finding these stories, and audiences want to know more about our nation's history, which I think is great. So, yeah.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick with us, film studies senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, as we talk about Academy Awards season and what you think should be of the nominations that you've seen. 800-642-1234 to join in. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Anna, Christopher Nolan already won a Best Director Award for Oppenheimer at the Golden Globes. In his career, has not yet won the title at the Oscars. Is this the year that Christopher Nolan wins?
Yes, I think that's a pretty pretty safe bet that that Christopher Nolan is going to take home the Academy Award, and you know, really ultimately for his you know, a body of work that has really always demanded a lot of attention from both audiences and critics. He came on the scene early in 2000, I think it was, with Memento, which was a movie that made a lot of waves. I think it debuted at Sundance, actually, from the very start, when Memento hit, kind of hit theaters, and critics really responded to it. Now, Christopher Nolan does have some things about his career. He's not always been the best director for women. That being said, I think that you have two very strong performances in Oppenheimer, and despite the fact, of course, that Oppenheimer is really obviously a man's story. Ultimately, mm-hmm. there's the performance of Florence Pugh as Jean Tatlock and Emily Blunt as Kitty Oppenheimer. Those two actresses, they did quite a bit with those roles. They're smaller roles, but they have definitely some showiness to them. And I think those are two characters Nolan, he did a good job with ultimately, given the constraints of the roles ultimately. And so, I think that is, that shows his evolution to some extent as a filmmaker as well, right? But I think just the sweep of Oppenheimer too is really going to the cinema, the epic sweep of that of the story is really going to help him just bring home that statuette ultimately.
Okay, so you did say open the door to Best Director for women. Is it a snub or not a snub with director Greta Gerwig and Barbie?
So that again, that of course, a few weeks ago, that was all the rage, the debate, right? And I saw Barbie in the theaters. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was surprised that Greta Gerwig was not nominated. I think that, and I've read a number of analysis about this. The body of folks that vote on just the director nominations is a pretty serious group. And I think that, Barbie, again, I really love the film, but there are those that would probably see it as a little bit of a lightweight, right? Narratively, it certainly doesn't have like the seriousness, of a movie like Oppenheimer, right? And then using, it is a really creative script, but ultimately it is a script based on a toy, right? And so that when it's just directors that are voting on nominations, that really kind of skews the nominating sort of nominated films in favor of weightier, heftier stories. And so one critic that I had read was that, it's not that the Academy has snubbed all women, right? Because you have the director Justine Triet of she is nominated for Anatomy of a Fall, which is ultimately a more serious, a more complex film than Barbie in some respects. And Greta Gerwig is nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. I do think she has an edge there to perhaps bring that home.
Okay.
She certainly, plenty of folks have taken notice because, Barbie was the highest grossing film ever directed by a woman. So, I wouldn't cry for Greta Gerwig at any point. I think her career is chugging along just fine.
Okay.
And
they'll
find lots of other projects, I'm sure, to helm. And I would even say that, a few years ago, Little Women, I think little her version of Little Women, I think ultimately, when we think about notions of, what makes for a serious Oscar film, Little Women is probably superior to Barbie in that, on that point, because it, it has that period appeal and the complexity of narrative.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies in English at UW-Whitewater. As we absorb the Oscar buzz, be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Academy Award nominations are unveiled, we check in with you on worthy Oscar contenders alongside analysis from UW-Whitewater Film Studies lecturer Anna Thompson-Hodgick. Be part of the conversation about memorable films. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Glenn in Stoughton. Glenn, hi.
Hello.
What film would you like to bring up?
Weirdly, I want to bring up, to me, the most surprising film of the year by far, Godzilla Minus One. If you would have told me, I would be moved to tears multiple times in a Godzilla movie, I would have said, you're nuts. It's not the Godzilla I grew up with as a kid. Fantastic movie that I've thought about many times since seeing it. And I had some reservations about some of the big films of the year. I definitely liked them, but Godzilla Minus One just knocked it out of the park.
Glenn, thank you. Anna, what do you think of that analysis?
Yeah, so I haven't seen that particular film. I had heard that, that it, received very good reviews. And just kind of a different take on kind of the Godzilla narrative, and so I thank the caller for bringing that film up. And it, I haven't seen it, but it's interesting to think about the history of Godzilla. The original Godzilla was released about a decade after the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so it is a, it always has kind of functioned as an allegory for nuclear war ultimately. And so, and from that Japanese perspective. And so, I think that's interesting. And I definitely, it makes me want to see the film for sure. So
Glenn, yeah. What comes up for you as you think back to what you saw, and why did it move you so much?
Well, for one thing, unlike the kind of goofier Godzilla movies that I grew up with, it really focuses on the characters. The monster is in the background to some degree. It's really about this family that comes together, and what they experience. Yeah, like I said, it's unbelievably emotional. I took a bunch of friends who were not Godzilla fans. you know, they're just like, oh, whatever, that'll be fun. And they all loved this movie. I thought everybody'd be, asking me, why did you take me to this? But it's super emotional. Also, there's echoes of classic films like Jaws in this
movie.
When they pull in the music from the original Godzilla movie in 1954, I mean, I had chills.
Well, it's interesting too. Glenn brings up music, because let's talk a little bit about scores, Anna. And You know, what you make of the score with Robbie Robertson has a posthumous nomination for Killers of the Flower Moon. And we had heard just there in our intro there, the Osage Oil Boom from the soundtrack. What do you make of these scores?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting to me because both the Killers of the Flower Moon and the Oppenheimer scores, they are not these kind of overbearing, you know, sort of sweeping scores that so often are, you know, get ascribed to the epic film. They're a little quieter. And, you know, I found both scores for both of those films to be, you know, just very effective in how they, you know, set the mood. I think, I had told your producer that Robbie Robertson, I think, may have the edge just because it is that posthumous nomination. He was never awarded an Academy Award before. And he has that long association with Martin Scorsese. And then Ludwig Göransson for Oppenheimer, both, you know, that score too really is, you know, it manages to be enough, but never too much in kind of in helping us to kind of understand the action and providing that mood. Now, the other interesting kind of nomination in the mix there is John Williams for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. And he would be the oldest recipient of an Academy Award at 92 years old if he wins. But I don't think he will. He's already got 5. So, you know, it is a nice, you know, inclusion there in the lineup of musicians. But yeah, he's got plenty.
Anna Thompson Hodgick with us, film studies senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, as we discuss the upcoming Academy Awards and the nominations. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Okay, so Best Actress, you say Lily Gladstone is likely to win Best Lead Actress for her role as Molly Burkhart in Killers of the Flower Moon. And let's hear a scene where Molly is laughing off Ernest Burkhart's early attempts to win her affection while driving her around town.
He told me he was going with Matt Williams for a time.
You talk too much.
No, I don't talk too much. Just thinking who I got to beat in this horse race, that's all.
I didn't realize this was a race. I don't care for watching horses.
Well, I'm a different kind of horse.
Hong Fashi. Shomikasi Sheko Shiajimi.
What was that?
Shomikasi. That's how you are.
What makes Gladstone a top contender for the award?
So, from a, again, a cultural standpoint, of course, she is the first Native woman to be nominated for this award. And so, you know, just again, there's that element of, you know, the culture, right? But, you know, her performance is a very effective performance. It's understated, and yet she is kind of the moral core of this film, right? When the film opens, it's her that we hear. And so she does not have as much screen time as some of the other actresses nominated in this category. And so I do think that there is a chance, right, that, you know, Emma Stone could come in there, just because Emma Stone, her performance in Poor Things is so masterful, and it's just an incredibly physical performance. But Emma Stone has an Oscar, right, already. And so
you always look at what's in the bank already. So, right. But right. This is my time to shout out to Annette Bening as in that category for her, you know, in the biopic Naiad. And, you know, I think she has I think she has a chance as well in playing that long-distance swimmer, Diana Nyad. UW-Whitewater Film Studies scholar Anna Thompson-Hodgick giving us analysis on the Academy Awards nominations. And let's hear from you. Call in with a question. Share comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That is Billie Eilish's What Was I Made For? It's one of two Barbie movie tracks up for Best Original Song. And we take stock of the nominees for the Oscars and hear about your picks. 265 films vying for Best Picture. The Academy revealed 10 films in contention for its top honor. Call in with a question. Share your reactions. 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick teaches film studies and English at UW-Whitewater. So Margot Robbie didn't receive a Best Lead Actress nomination for her role as Barbie. What do you make of Margot Robbie's name being off that list of nominees?
Well, I mean, again, it was surprising to me. I mean, I thought she did a very capable job there, but she did. You know, she is nominated as a producer credit for Best Picture, so she'll still get to go, right? She's gonna be there, but you know, there again, kind of critics have said, you know, she was nominated, right, for her portrayal of Tanya Harding in I, Tanya, and that arguably was a more complexly rendered role, right, than Barbie. And so, you know, again, I did find it surprising. I really enjoyed that film. I enjoyed her performance. But again, with her off that list, it does sort of make room for other individuals like Sandra Hüller, right, for her performance in Anatomy of a Fall. And Sandra Hüller gave two really strong performances this year, both in Anatomy of a Fall and in Zone of Interest. And so when we have a more sort of international contingent of voters in the Academy membership, right, we see a wider spectrum of folks that are nominated ultimately. And so, I mean, I think it would be interesting to know kind of where Margot Robbie fell in the voting, and if Hüller was the kind of the factor there that kind of, you know, pushed her out. And then of course you mentioned you're a fan of Nyad. Annette Bening, you know, this is her fifth nomination and she still has not won an Academy Award.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that I think that, you know, it would be great, honestly, if Annette Bening did finally bring it home. I don't think she will, but you know, she's 65 years old. She's been around in Hollywood now for quite a while, turning up, you know, really consistently strong performances, you know, all the way back to the Grifters in the early 1990s. And so, you know, her embodiment of Diana Nyad, I think, is so fully developed. And I think too, she and Jodie Foster together are so fun to watch.
They are. Oh, my goodness. I mean, yeah. How often are Oscars about someone's career rather than a single film?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, sometimes they are. I mean, a lot of times they are, actually, you know, kind of looking. And I think when Leonardo DiCaprio won for The Revenant, I mean, that was a really amazing performance, but it was just as much about kind of the body of work when he won. And so it is a little surprising to with Annette Bening in her case that there hasn't been more sort of buzz that she could finally bring it home, just because, you know, she's been overlooked now so many times. Angela Bassett's another example where finally, you know, the Academy gave her an honorary Academy Award last year, and because she kept getting overlooked again and again and again. And I think Angela Bassett is younger than Annette Bening. So, I mean, that's interesting too, right? That Angela Bassett got her honorary statuette last year.
You're running the numbers, I think, there.
Yeah.
You talked about the international influence in these categories and the Academy calling itself a global organization representing the best of an international art form. How international is the Academy compared to previous years?
So I guess I can't tell you exactly the percentage there, but in 2016 is when they really kind of, you know, rejiggered their membership. And that was in the wake of the Oscars So White campaign, you know, that really pushed back against the lack of diversity in nominations. And so, you know, there was kind of this reckoning in the membership that, okay, we do really need to, you know, broaden our ranks. And so that as a result of that, yeah, we just see, you know, we see movies like Past Lives, for example, from Korea in our Best Picture lineup. We see Anatomy of a Fall from Germany. We see Zone of Interest that kind of has both German and British kind of origins. And so it really, you know, to see those movies too in the Best Picture lineup, you know, that has a real factor in how many people are going to seek them out to watch them. And then it has an effect on distribution. So the fact that, you know, I watched with my family Anatomy of a Fall last weekend, and you know, we could just stream it, right? We don't have to live in New York or Los Angeles to see these movies. We can stream them, you know, off Amazon or off Netflix, and it provides those movies then with a visibility that they just didn't have a decade ago or two decades ago.
I can feel exactly what you said there. I mean, we just last weekend sat down with a family and watched NIAID with my swimmer daughter and told her not to complain anymore about those long distance 500s. But again, you know, it was much more accessible to us to be able to see an Oscar contender. You know, with that said, the Oscars used to be a really big TV event, and viewership has been up for the past 2 years, though still historically low. How do you think that this year's event will compare to, you know, recent years?
So my prediction is that the ratings will be certainly up from last year. And I think part of it, you know, every time we have movies that do well at the box office that are nominated in these prime categories, then the viewership, the ratings do increase. And so historically, you know, the number one Oscar telecast for ratings was 1998, when Titanic, you know, was kind of brought home all those awards. And we've never again experienced ratings that high. But the fact that both Oppenheimer and Barbie are nominated, I think will certainly help with the ratings. I also think you have some really, you know, thinking about kind of the way the telecast goes, some songs that are nominated, obviously all the songs get featured, right? And so I think a lot of people are going to be tuning in to watch Ryan Gosling's performance of I'm Just Ken, because I imagine it's going to be quite the showstopper, right?
Give your two cents there, you know, having Ryan Gosling there, and it, you know, and not having Margot Robbie, what do you think of Ken getting that nomination?
Yeah. I mean, the optics of it certainly aren't great, right? And so when, you know, in the day and 2 days after the nominations were released, certainly I saw quite a bit on my social media, you know, that, you know, this is the patriarchy. This is exactly how Hollywood has always worked, right? I think it's unfortunate in some respects, but, you know, I think Robert Downey Jr. ultimately is going to take home the Academy Award, not Ryan Gosling. So I don't know. It's a kind of a tricky situation. But I Ryan Gosling, I'm sure, will be there to perform the song. Billie Eilish, of course, will be there, and I think she'll ultimately take the Academy Award home for best song.
Well, let's pause there on best original song this year. We're going to hear part of Wazaza, the song for My People from Killers of the Flower Moon. So the ceremony itself features the performances for song nominees. What are you expecting from this year's stage performances?
I think, you know, again, just that charisma, I'm sure, will exude from the various performers. And again, with, you know, I'm Just Ken, I imagine that, you know, I remember years ago when it was one of the nominated songs was Blame Canada from the South Park film.
Yeah.
Robin Williams performed it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's all that pageantry and you know, all the bells and whistles. So I expect that certainly will likely be a high point of the night. And then, you know, certainly more reflective, more serious songs like What Was I Made For, you know, that will be kind of, you know, more of a contemplative moment. A Song for My People, you know, that also being a little bit more contemplative, right? So the dynamics will certainly be interesting there to watch with the performances, the music performances.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater, as we discuss the Academy Award nominations, taking it all in. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We talk about the Academy Award nominations from a year where a record 3 films directed by women were nominated for Best Picture, Barbie, Anatomy of a Fall, and Past Lives. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies and English at UW-Whitewater, is our guide. We're going to move on here to Best Supporting Actress and take a look at Jodie Foster for her role as Bonnie Stoll in Diana Nyad's Best Friend and Swim Coach. That's, as we talked about, played by Annette Bening. And so let's hear a scene where Stoll decides to stay with Nyad on her swim from Havana, Cuba to Key West.
I tried doing my own thing, but it just wasn't the same.
You're not a quitter.
Point is, we're getting old together. You know, we're getting old. And if you die, I want to be the last person you see. But don't die. But if you do, I'm going to be right there with you.
What are Jodie Foster's chances of winning for Best Supporting Actress?
Well, I don't think she probably has much of a chance, just because I've Divine Joy Rudolph from The Holdovers, I think, has kind of been favored there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I've also heard that Danielle Brooks might have a shot for The Color Purple as well. And so and of course, again, Jodie Foster has 2 Oscars already. She achieved them both before she was 30 years old, which is kind of incredible. But I think too, you know, the supporting actor categories, that's oftentimes an area where, you know, say The Holdovers, right, is not going to win Best Picture. So mm-hmm. then where else can we award, you know, this film? And so that, you know, is, I think, too obviously a calculation of voters in that sense. And I should note that, you know, Paul Giamatti also has a real shot to win Best Actor for The Holdovers. And this is a film by Alexander Payne, who Alexander Payne is not nominated as a director, but, you know, he's another director that's been turning out really consistently strong films for quite a long time, you know, starting with Election in the late 1990s, you know, more recently movies like Nebraska, Sideways. Mm-hmm. And so I think that Divine Joy Rudolph will be a sort of a way to award not just The Holdovers itself, but also, you know, kind of a conciliatory prize for Alexander Payne as well. So, but I love Jodie Foster's performance in Nyad. I mean, we really have some excellent work all the way through that category. Even America Ferrera, right? No, that was rather controversial that she got nominated for Barbie in that category. A lot of folks have said that, you know, she's really there because of that monologue that she delivered that was very impressive that in Barbie, it kind of that standalone. I mean, that part was a much smaller role than any of the other roles in that category. So, yeah.
So when you look at the puzzle pieces of the Oscars in a way, and what films go where. So there are 24 Oscar categories, and I'm just wondering, you know, as we Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor, Actress, that gets all the attention. Is there any category you think we should care more about or that seems to get overlooked?
That's a good question. I think, you know, I always feel like the screenwriting is something that could get more play than it does. Mm. You know, especially this year when, you know, the writer's strike was so hard on the industry and of course the actors too, but you know, the famous screenwriter, then eventually director Billy Wilder always said that writers were the most important people in Hollywood. And I don't, honestly, the writers have never gotten, you know, the respect I think that they ultimately deserve for, ultimately being the storytellers, right? And so I wish, yeah, sometimes I do wish that the screenplay categories would just be elevated just a little bit more than they are. Mm. I also, this year in particular, sound, you know, the best sound is oftentimes it's dominated by, you know, the kind of blockbuster movies. Mission Impossible, I think, you know, was in that category this year. And just, you know, the movies that are, you know, the more sort of not as intellectual, you might say. Uh-huh. But this year it's interesting because I have not seen it yet. The Zone of Interest is a film that is tells the story of the commandant of Auschwitz and his family and how they lived essentially right next to Auschwitz. And the way that the horror of Auschwitz is relayed in this film is largely through its sound. Hmm. And the way some really interesting things it sounds like are done through sound. And so, you know, I just think it would be fascinating if that film won Best Sound, because it is so different and so creative as compared to, you know, just your typical explosions and car chases in a movie like Mission Impossible. So
it goes beyond that, right?
Right.
I'm just wondering if you notice more, and I don't even know if it has anything to do with the strikes or work stoppages, but like just the crossover of directors, also getting producer credits, getting screenwriter credits, like just kind of how Hollywood seems to be having a lot, maybe just more crossover into these different areas of you know, the artistry of these movies. And I'm just wondering if you notice anything there.
Well, I just think that, you know, ultimately, I think the lessons from a lot of these movies this year is that, you know, it takes a lot of luck to get a movie made in the first place, mm-hmm. and a lot of happenstance. And so with Oppenheimer, for example, There was an LA Times essay a few months ago about the long path, the book American Prometheus, on which Oppenheimer is based. How first the path to getting that book finished, but then through just a whole series of occurrences, the book came to the attention of the actor James Woods, and James Woods brought the book to the attention of Christopher Nolan.
Who read it three times, I understand. Over 700 pages.
And so how movies get made in the first place, it was kind of an incredible story. The documentary category is really interesting in that respect too. And so you have a movie like the Tiger movie. Mm-hmm. You have Mindy Kaling is a producer on that, right? To Kill a Tiger. Mindy Kaling and Dev Patel. So two really kind of heavy hitters in Hollywood really had to, you know, be involved, right? To in order to get a movie like that made. And I think it does come down to money. And ultimately at the end of the day, movie making is a business. And so you need people in power and you need people who have money to get movies made. And that is an unfortunate truth, but that's why certain movies get so much more publicity and become the hot movie, is because they have that machinery behind them.
That machinery behind them. And in our last moments together, movie theaters, are they still alive? And is it the Barbenheimer phenomenon that they have to thank?
Well, they are still alive. I mean, they've had a tough go these last few years, of course. But I mean, I think, again, the Barbenheimer phenomenon, it just really proved that people do want to see movies in theaters. And I guess I can close out here by, you know, Martin Scorsese, at the end of Killers of the Flower Moon, you know, he essentially says to his audience, like, you know, thank you for coming to see this movie in a theater, right? And you know, it was kind of self-referential, of course, in a way, but also like that, you know, theaters do really still have a role to play in our culture, and they are perhaps a little more endangered than they used to be. But, you know, industry critics have been saying all the way back to the 1950s that movie theaters were in trouble. Mm-hmm. So, and they're still very much around. So,
Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's been fun.
It has. Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer of Film Studies in English at UW-Whitewater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.